And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. Coming up, we hear part one of a panel discussion on the 2016 presidential election. Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment. With speakers, author Vanessa Williamson and Professor Cedric Johnson. Followed at 10 with Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. We'll round out the hour with flashpoints, a look at how various dictators, drug traffickers, and other corporate movers and shakers stole $12 trillion from the world's poorest countries and held it offshore. At 11, it's part two of the 2016 presidential election with Cedric Johnson and Thomas Ferguson. And thanks, KBOO members, for helping us come so very close to our goal in the spring membership drive. You can still help to put us over the top at kboo.fm. You click on the word donate right at the top. And now, 2016 presidential election. Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment.
For people younger than me, I think, even for me, the tax revolt is not a salient political memory for me. Reagan is not a salient political memory for me. So people in my age or younger grew up in a time when you could vote for tax increases, when that's something that happened, right? They grew up in a time where you saw the struggle it was to pass legislation, like, for instance, Obamacare, which is a massively redistributional policy, the struggle that you faced, even if you're trying to do a very moderate policy, right? So I think that for young people, it may be the case that the things Sanders talking about don't seem as politically impossible because the salient political memories of the sort of Reagan era are not salient to them. And so I think that for many older Democrats, they think that Sanders' plans are good. They're just pie in the sky. I think younger people, that's not how they're seeing those policies.
That was Vanessa Williamson on the topic of the 2016 elections, Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment. This is a program by Global Voices for Justice, a nonprofit media organization. I'm Jeannie Kyle. Political expectations have been shaken in both the Republican and Democratic parties by the spectacular rise of two 2016 presidential candidates, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. What are the social bases of their respective challenges, and what accounts for the timing of their extraordinary successes? In this two-part program, we have three speakers who discuss these campaigns and their historical contexts, as well as their likely future trajectories. Author Vanessa Williamson, Professor Cedric Johnson, and Professor Thomas Ferguson. First, we will hear from author Vanessa Williamson, a fellow in Governor's Studies at Brookings. She focuses on the politics of redistribution and on attitudes about taxation. She is the author, along with Harvard professor Theda Skocpol, of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. The event was held at UCLA on April 11, 2016.
Thank you so much for having me. So I want to talk to you today about the 2016 elections. I was asked to talk about the 2016 elections, Trump, Sanders, and political transformation. But in a way, the title is somewhat misleading because I don't actually really want to talk about Trump and Sanders very much. Instead, I want to talk about the political processes that have got us to where we are today. So just to draw out the metaphor a little bit, this is a Rube Goldberg device.
You may have seen it before. It's a mouse trap. As you can see, the mouse goes in at the beginning, and he wants to get the cheese, and he goes through various obstacles and sort of, you know, challenges and overcomes them, and some things help him along, and he ends up in a little basket and gets shot into space, right? So this is Rube Goldberg's mouse trap, and I think it's a good metaphor for elections because we have a certain number of mice that go in at the beginning, and the challenges and obstacles are actually there no matter what mouse you're talking about. So if Sanders and Trump are my mice, I want to talk more about the trap around them. Okay, so we're going to talk more about processes than personalities. And in terms of the left, these are the political changes that I want to focus on. I want to talk a little bit about the pro-government American. I'm going to talk a little bit about the challenges of overlapping inequalities in the United States. And I'm going to talk about the possibilities for movement consolidation on the left. And then on the right, I want to talk a little bit about the motivations of the conservative base and how that plays into Donald Trump's support. I want to talk about the role of the media in contemporary politics and, in particular, the role of the media in conservative politics. And I'm going to talk about the rise of political entrepreneurs. And we're actually going to start on the right. And so this is this section is going to draw a little bit on my previous work on the Tea Party, because in many ways I think that there's strong connections between what you're seeing with Donald Trump and what we saw with the Tea Party in the first years of the Obama administration. So I'm going to talk about three things. I'm going to talk about grassroots conservatives, I'm going to talk about the right-wing media, and I'm going to talk about political entrepreneurs. And we're going to start with the grassroots conservatives. First of all, I want to make it clear that the Tea Party and Trump supporters are not demographically exactly the same people. I mean, obviously there are some people who were in both camps, but they're not precisely the same. They have some things in common. One reason you might think that Trump supporters are Tea Party supporters is because Trump supporters are in general older, they are whiter, and they're more male than sort of the broader population. But Trump supporters are also less educated and less wealthy than the public at large. And the Tea Party, by contrast, was more educated and more wealthy than the public at large. And Trump supporters are much less closely tied to the Republican Party than Tea Party supporters. And this, I think, is the most important thing to think about in terms of the demographics. Tea Party supporters were politically engaged before being involved in the Tea Party. Now, they may not have been involved in electoral politics, although many of the activists I spoke to had been, but they were civically engaged. And remember, these are older conservative people. These are often retirees. These are people you imagine sort of attending local meetings. These are people who had been on the library board, who had been to school board meetings when their kids were young. So these are civically engaged people who are closely tied to the Republican Party and much more likely to engage in all kinds of civic activism, political activism, including being more likely to vote. By contrast, Trump supporters are less closely tied to the Republican Party and considerably less likely to vote on average than the public at large and than other Republicans. All right. So they're quite different on demographic grounds once you're looking within older white conservatives. But in terms of beliefs, even though they're not precisely the same people, the Trump supporters and the Tea Party are really very similar indeed. And I just want to talk about a few of the ways in which their beliefs are similar. First and probably foremost is that Trump supporters are very strongly motivated by anti-immigrant sentiment. This is one of the aspects of Trump supporters that makes them different from supporters of other Republican candidates like Ted Cruz. Trump supporters are much more strongly motivated by immigration questions and by, in general, questions about dangers external to the United States. Similarly, Tea Party supporters were extremely highly motivated by anti-immigrant sentiment, and this is something that didn't get a lot of attention at the beginning of the Tea Party. There was a lot of focus on sort of taxes and budgets, and it's not that those things weren't concerns that people were raising. I mean, people said that T stood for taxed enough already, and I'll talk a little bit about what that meant. But when I surveyed Tea Party activists in the Massachusetts area, which is not the highest immigration state in the country by far, the second most important issue for them after taxes and the budget was immigration. And this is early 2010. So we're talking about quite a long time before the most recent round of immigration debates in this country. Immigration was already a primary interest for many people in the Tea Party. And that sort of fits in with some of the other themes we'll talk about. Trump supporters are also very protective of government programs for people they see as deserving, right? You probably remember Trump saying far less harsh things about Social Security and Medicare than you've heard from other Republican candidates, than you hear from someone like Paul Ryan. He talks about protecting those programs. And Tea Party activists are also strongly supportive of Social Security and Medicare. Many of them are, of course, Social Security and Medicare recipients. But it's part of a larger ideological commitment on their part to government programs that go to people they see as deserving. Now, of course, the question is who is deserving? And there's been great work done by people other than me, but excellent work looking specifically at what people in the Tea Party meant by that. And it is largely substantively motivated by sort of a racial resentment idea. So that younger people, minorities, are sort of assumed to not have worked hard enough to be relying on the state because of a lack of personal initiative, as opposed to fine, upstanding Americans like themselves who did their part and now deserve the benefits that they earned. But the important thing to think about here is that protecting major government investments like Social Security and Medicare is at the base, right, the base of the Tea Party, is at odds with much of the rhetoric you hear from the elite part of the Tea Party, sort of the aspects of the Tea Party that were funded by like groups like the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, that kind of thing. They really commit themselves to a very extreme free market ideology, which is not the attitude of rank and file Tea Party supporters. Rank and file Tea Party supporters are, in fact, defend, at least for themselves and people they see as deserving, major government investments in the social safety net. Now, that anti-immigrant sentiment and the sort of racial resentment that underlies a lot of these attitudes comes together with a sort of broader feeling of nostalgia in Tea Party activists and also in Donald Trump supporters, sort of a fear of cultural change. This is not the country I grew up in. And Barack Obama was very much seen as a symbol of that new America, that changed America, right? And I think that was actually something that was true on the right and the left, that Barack Obama was a symbol of change. And for some people, that was hope. And for other people, it was quite frightening. So there's this nostalgia that younger America is a more diverse America, it's a different America, and it's not my America, was a sentiment I heard over and over again when I spoke to people in the Tea Party. Last two pieces, I think you also hear resonance of with Trump. First of all, a significant skepticism about science and expertise. And I think, I mean, with Trump, you know, again and again you see people in the media, and sort of maybe even Republican leaders, they're sort of trying to fact-check Donald Trump. And it doesn't seem to have any impact. It's like facts bounce right off, you know, and why is this not mattering for his support? Well, the Republican Party has committed itself in a significant way to undermining science, undermining the idea of science, undermining scientific consensus like global warming. And I heard a lot of that concern of, you know, sort of elites in fancy universities on the coasts, not to name names, looking down on middle America. Right, and there was just there was in general a sense of doubt about what scientists say, what experts tell me are facts, and this is something that travels right through the Trump movement. Finally, though Tea Party activists were not free market ideologues by any stretch of the imagination, there was a real conviction that wealthy people had earned their money. Right, that wealthy people were successful people, hardworking people, represent the best of America. They're, you know, many people in the Tea Party either owned or had owned small businesses, and so they see themselves sort of a type with far larger business owners. And so I think that that also plays out in the Trump phenomenon that you see. I mean, Donald Trump has been selling kind of a language of success, you know, sort of buy into my sort of brand, which is fundamentally about business success, and I think that that's one of the other ways in which these movements are very similar. All right, so demographically, kind of the same, but not completely the same. Ideologically, striking similarities when it comes to grassroots conservatives in the Trump phenomenon and in the Tea Party. All right, so now I want to talk a little bit about right-wing media. And just a reminder, in case you don't recall the origins of the Tea Party, in February 2009, so we are talking about the very first weeks of the Obama administration, this is a man named Rick Santelli. He was a host for CNBC. This is him broadcasting from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. He was supposed to give a relatively normal broadcast, you know, updating on the Mercantile Exchange. Instead, he goes on a rant about Barack Obama's housing policies, which had just been released. And the language sounds very familiar now. It's a sort of language of makers and takers, and that this policy that Barack Obama is putting forward will take your money and give it to people who are undeserving, who made bad choices, who made stupid choices about, you know, building extra bathrooms on their home, is what he says. And that this is fundamentally not only a bad idea, but an un-American idea, that the founding fathers would be rolling over in their graves. And he calls for a Chicago Tea Party, right? And now there had already been anti-Obama protests, but they hadn't got a single set of symbols to rally around, and they hadn't also gotten very much attention. But this language gets picked up within hours by conservative radio hosts across the country, and you hear these clips of him on the TV over and over again. And then, so it starts with conservative radio, it moves quickly to Fox News. This is a screenshot from Fox News in the weeks leading up to the April 15th, 2009. Tea Parties. And as you can see, or maybe you can't quite, that's Glenn Beck and that's Sean Hannity. And so they sent their hosts to cities around the country and promoted those to where the Tea Parties were going to be. And they, in fact, acted sort of as MCs or sort of special guests at the Tea Party events of April 15th, which, of course, drew huge crowds, in part as a result, largely as a result of the sort of round-the-clock coverage that Fox News gave them. And I can show you that. I mean, the extent to which Fox News made itself a part of the Tea Party is obvious even in the headline here. You see FNC, Fox News Channel, Tax Day Tea Parties, right? So Fox News attached their brand, which is worth a lot with older white conservatives, attached their brand to the Tea Parties very early on. And the results are pretty clear mathematically. So this is a chart of Tea Party coverage. It's simply the frequency of how often anyone said the phrase Tea Party. in the spring, in that same spring. The peak here is those April 15th rallies, and the dark bars are CNN, the lighter bars are Fox News. And as you can see, CNN, at the moment of the actual rallies, talked about the Tea Party even more than Fox News. But what Fox News does that's interesting is slowly ramps up coverage for several weeks, in fact, months in advance, and then the coverage tails off very slowly too, right? So what you see with Fox News is them not just playing the role of covering an event, right, which is what CNN does, but as they play what we call in our book a sort of social movement organizer role, right? That they are creating a sort of shared language for Fox News viewers to understand that the Tea Party is for them, right? And you've got to remember, older conservatives do not normally come out of a protest tradition, right? So you're asking people to engage in a kind of political activity that's unusual for them. That sort of contestatory in the street politics is not necessarily what people who are in the Tea Party were comfortable with. Many told me they'd never been to a rally before the Tea Parties. But with the language of Fox News sort of telling you that you should go, in fact, literally telling you that you should go, and them getting to see your favorite hosts live in person in your town, you know, these were things that really helped increase turnout. Now, how does that relate to Donald Trump, right? So Donald Trump he is not a conservative radio host, for instance, though he is beloved by many of them. But Donald Trump recognized what had happened to the media landscape, right? Because what you see is ideas develop in the right-wing media sort of echo chamber, as some other scholars have called it, and then filter out into the mainstream media. You see that CNN covers the Tea Parties more than Fox does, right, when they actually happen. So those ideas filter out of the conservative media, and the mainstream media will pick them up. And the mainstream media has a very hard time if something seems, you know, brightly colored and controversial like the Tea Party did. You'll remember that these are people dressing up in revolutionary garb and standing in the street shouting. I mean, it's very eye-catching, right? So the mainstream media has a very hard time putting down something that's eye-catching. And Donald Trump, I mean, fundamentally is extremely eye-catching in any of a number of ways. But also, I mean, he's a product of the media. This is what he does, right? He was a brand. Like he was he put his name on things and sold them on a tremendously wide array of things, right? And he had his own sort of base that he could come from, right? He knew how to work. I mean, he sort of out-Fox-newsed Fox, right? So I think that it's not that they're the same phenomenon, but they're operating in the same environment. They're operating in the same media environment. What Trump managed to do was take advantage of what had become of the media system, right? And some of the ways in which the media system is skewed or biased or has sort of struggled in some ways, I think Trump managed to sort of step into that void. All right. And that leads really clearly into the last thing I want to talk about, which is political entrepreneurs. So this is David Koch here, and he is talking at an Americans for Prosperity event. He is obviously one of the Koch brothers, one of the wealthiest people in the world. And Americans for Prosperity is one of the conservative organizations he helps run. I'll talk about more of them. But David Koch and, to a lesser extent, Donald Trump are both political entrepreneurs. And they've both recognized a moment of, in some sense, malfunction in the Republican Party and stepped into that breach. And they've stepped into it differently, but I think it's a similar phenomenon. So let's talk a little bit about the breach. There are many ways of thinking about the sort of decline of mainstream Republican institutions. You can look at the complete collapse of moderate Republicans in Congress. I picked this just because it's a really neat graph. This is George W. Bush's approval ratings over the course of his tenure. He leaves office with some of the lowest approval ratings in the time in which we have approval ratings for presidents. And it's not just that George W. Bush was personally unpopular, but he sort of left the Republican Party in a moment of crisis because the sort of institutions associated with him, sort of Karl Rove's institutions among others, didn't seem like they were getting the job done in terms of being able to convince voters that the Republican Party was for them, right? And the Republican Party has been struggling with various demographic challenges for a while, but it wasn't obvious that they were managing to step outside their base. So there are various ways in which, you might think about the fact that, for instance, the RNC at the time was in a state of complete, the Republican National Committee was in a state of complete crisis, huge fundraising problems during the same period. So who steps in? Well, one group of people who step in, or two brothers who step in, are the Koch brothers. This is a very simple analysis of the major organizations that the Koch brothers fund that are sort of part of what you should really think of as a shadow party. And at the bottom is simply a timeline going back to 1975. So as you can see, the Koch brothers have been tremendously successful in And for a long time participated in production of conservative and libertarian ideas. Here we have the Cato Institute and so forth. But then there are all these new organizations that spring up here at the end, particularly during the Obama administration, that do things like policy advocacy, that do things like organize other donors to participate in their projects, and then also constituency mobilization, the most successful of which is by far Americans for Prosperity, which has chapters all over the country, is very involved in state politics in particular, and getting state legislation passed. And then finally, they even have sort of what we call utilities. This is from a paper that Theda Scotchpole and I are working on, part of a larger project. Utilities, which are doing things like turning out voters, maintaining voter files, all the sorts of things that you think of a party as doing. So what you have here is sort of a shadow party that's been built outside or partly within the sort of crumbling infrastructure of the Republican Party. And I'm not joking when I say it's a shadow party. It's actually larger than the RNC by several measures. They have 1,200 year-round full-time staff, which is three times the RNC staffing. They're expected to spend $889 million this year, which is twice what the RNC spent in 2012. So the Koch brothers have sort of stepped into the breach as other Republican organizations have declined. And I think you can think of Trump as having done, in many ways, the same thing. Now, the Kochs are limited to an important extent by the fact that they are ideologically committed to a very extreme version of free market politics, right? They come out of a libertarian background themselves personally, but they, and of course that is also in line with their interests as very wealthy people and very wealthy businessmen, so it is both ideology and interest. But they're limited by that ideology to some extent, because as we spoke about earlier, the conservative base is actually not a bunch of free market ideologues, right? So they're challenged in some way by those limits. Donald Trump faces no such challenges, to the best of my knowledge. He does not have an ideology that is coherent, limiting in any meaningful way. So what he did was take all the positions that are most popular with the Republican base. Right, he was willing to say things about immigration. He was willing to say things about minorities that had previously been unacceptable to say explicitly, if maybe imply, but never say. Right, he was willing to say them. But at the same time, he was perfectly willing to say that free trade might be bad and that Social Security is good. And he was just willing to take the full range of positions that are popular and hold them all. Because to the extent that I think there's a coherent ideology behind Donald Trump, it is one of self-aggrandizement. Right. So there was no reason for him not to take all the best positions, which is one reason I think you can see him doing so well in this presidential primary. Now, the last thing I'll say about this before we move on is just that the fact that the Koch brothers did not get to pick their presidential candidate should not be understood as a limit on their success in any meaningful way. And I'll talk about some of the ways that the states are in Republican hands later. But you've got to remember, a lot of what free market ideologues would like to do is stop government from doing things. And in the American system, you can stop government from doing things without holding the presidency. You just need one branch of Congress, right? So if you can impose austerity via gridlock, I mean, I'm sure there are, of course, values to having the presidency as well, but the value of the presidency is not as large for the conservative movement right now as it would be for the left. Because what the left would like to do, as we'll talk about, is big government interventions. Well, you need the presidency for that, right? But that's not actually a requirement to do most of what the Koch brothers would like. A lot of that can be done from the minority. All right. So that's the right. I'll move quickly on to the left. So similarly, I want to talk about three things here. I want to talk about a pro-government America. I want to talk about overlapping inequalities. And I'm going to talk about whether you should expect movement consolidation on the left. Let's start with pro-government America. Oh, I don't know why this doesn't look nice. That's genuinely bizarre looking. Whatever, I'll make it up. So, the myth of the anti-government American. This is a picture of Cliven Bundy. You may have recognized him. This is the guy his sons took over a bird preserve, he didn't want to pay the fees he was supposed to pay for grazing his cattle on public lands. So I think this is in some ways the image many people have of what Americans are like, right? They don't care much about inequality. They just want government out of their business. They don't want to pay any taxes. And they think they're middle class, right? And I'm going to argue that actually that's kind of a limited vision of America. In fact, it's a wildly inaccurate vision of America. Americans are, as others have put it, philosophical conservatives but operational liberals. What does that mean? It means if you ask them, do they like small government, they'll say yes. And then if you ask them about each major thing government does, they like that and would like to spend more on it. Right? So yeah, sure, they think that small government is a nice principle. At the same time, they're like, education, Social Security, Medicare, healthcare more broadly, these things are things, I like these things. Yeah, military, absolutely. You know, so all the things that we actually spend money on, roads, schools, that stuff's popular. Right? So though you might hear some agreement about the idea of philosophical conservatism, that doesn't mean that people aren't liberals when it comes down to brass tacks. Similarly, there's widespread belief that Americans don't care about economic inequality. You've probably heard that people dramatically underestimate how much CEOs get paid, and that's absolutely true. But though their estimates are much too small, they have been getting larger, and people have been wanting them to be making less. Right? So they're getting the scope wrong, right? And I think, frankly, it's sometimes very hard, even for people who are involved in thinking about this on a regular basis, to remember what the scope really is of how big inequality is in this country. But that doesn't mean they don't care about it. In fact, people are very concerned about it. And one of the ways that you know they're concerned about it is if you ask Americans whether the rich should pay more in taxes, they say yes. And they say yes by overwhelming majorities. Between two-thirds and three-quarters of people think the rich should pay more in taxes. And that doesn't, and that stands up against any question wording you want to put in. I have seen it asked, do you think the government should engage in, I think it was actually massive redistribution by heavy taxes on the rich. Certainly it was heavy taxes on the rich, and that's got exactly as much support as any other question you want to ask about whether the rich should be paying more. All right, so I want to talk about two other things that about the sort of myth of the American who hates government is sort of inaccurate. And this is just Gallup's data on your social class identification, right? So the green line at the top is people who say they're upper, middle, or middle class. The yellow line in the middle is working and lower class. And then at the bottom, you've got people who describe, the dark green line is people who describe themselves as upper class. As you, I'm sure you're not surprised to hear, not many people think of themselves as upper class. But what's interesting is that the percentage of Americans who say they are working or lower class has been rising steadily for decades. Right? So you've probably heard, oh, all Americans think they're middle class. Everyone's middle class, right? Well, actually, 48% of Americans describe themselves as working in lower class now. This is a fundamental shift in terms of how people imagine their place in the economic order. So it may be true that how many billions CEOs make is sometimes a little blurry. People have a hard time imagining exactly how rich the rich are. But that does not mean that they do not recognize that the economic conditions of this country have shifted fundamentally. Right? Okay. So that's one thing worth keeping in mind the next time you hear that Americans haven't noticed what's happened to the economy. Here's another way. This is actually from my own research. Another way of looking at Americans' commitment to government. So I've talked about the fact that Americans are willing to pay, want the rich to pay more in taxes. They also are willing to pay more in taxes themselves. This the bottom line is just a timeline from the mid-70s, 1978 to 2014. Each dot represents the tax-increasing state ballot measures, right? So this is California. I do not need to explain this here. But across the country, states sometimes vote on tax measures. And sometimes they're voting on measures to increase taxes. And they did here with Prop 30 a few years ago. And the size of the dot is relative to the number of measures. So as you can see, it's not that there have been many, like a lot more tax-increasing state ballot measures over the years. That has really varied. But what has happened is they've gotten much more successful. This is the fraction of measures passing. And in the period of the tax revolt, which some of you may remember, and certainly UCLA institutionally will remember, there were almost no successful tax-increasing state ballot measures. Less than one in five would pass during that period. Now, for the last 15 years, more than half of measures aimed at increasing taxes, right? Voters choosing to increase taxes by popular referendum, right? More than half have passed. So the tax revolt was a really long time ago, and I think we sometimes forget that. You know, because the fiscal implications for states like California, where I've lived, Massachusetts, where I've also lived, are certainly still with us. But the public's changed its place on this, right? The public's voting for tax increases. And I should say, these aren't just tax increases on the rich. A lot of these are sales tax increases. So people are actually voting, and I mean, you saw a campaign like this in Arizona, that, you know, if you put a campaign before the voters that says, we're going to close schools, or our hospitals are going to suffer, or you can pay 0.25% more when you go to the store, a lot of people are like, oh, I'll pay 0.25% more. Right? So it's not impossible to pass a tax increase in the country. And again, in California, you guys will know this instinctively, but this is particularly remarkable because most measures don't pass, right? When you think about what goes on, you know, you get your long ballot, like most measures don't pass. Most tax increasing measures do, right? So there's been a real shift in the country, I think. And so my thought about the Bernie Sanders phenomenon is that we're beginning to see politicians starting to recognize that the country's moved a little bit. And so this is a headline from a couple months ago. Is $250,000 middle class Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders think so? Bernie Sanders, until a few months ago, held the same line as Hillary Clinton, held the same line as Barack Obama, held the same line as Bill Clinton, that they were only going to raise taxes on people making more than $250,000 a year. Right? You may remember that from the 2008 campaign. Barack Obama said it over and over and over again. He was only going to raise taxes over $250,000 a year. Bill Clinton had made the same commitment. This has been a standard Democratic position. Well, then Bernie Sanders put forth a health plan that would have been Medicare for all, right, and various other plans, family and medical leave. And he got asked how he was going to pay for it. And I and anyone else who looks at taxes were like, well, he's going to need a payroll tax to cover that, right? Because how do we pay for things like Social Security and Medicare? We pay for it with payroll taxes. And so when Bernie Sanders put forth his tax plan, it included payroll taxes. And what did that mean? It meant that if you calculate the amount of taxes you're going to pay under Bernie Sanders, this is a married couple making $60,000 a year with one child, you're going to pay a lot more under Bernie Sanders, right? Because what you're going to get under his plans would be Medicare, right? So presumably you don't then have to pay for health insurance and various other things would, of course, be free, and you don't see any of that in this chart. But the point is, this is a very large tax increase, right? And this is how Bernie Sanders is doing in the polls. I don't think that 15 or 20 years ago, and by the way, I should say, Bernie Sanders has not been sneaky on the subject of whether he's going to raise taxes on people. He got asked in a debate, are you going to raise taxes on the middle class? His answer was literally yes. That's what he said, right? So he has not done a bunch of hand-waving to disguise the fact that his plans involve some tax increases, right? And so Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have been polling relatively close nationally for quite a long time. And I think that's a really striking phenomenon that you wouldn't have expected even 10 or 15 years ago. All right. I want to talk about the sort of major demographic break between Clinton and Sanders, which is the youth vote, right? So this is support for Clinton and Sanders. Oh, I should say the green line is people who are not sure, haven't decided, or not going to vote. So people are going to vote for Sanders. People are going to vote for Clinton. Among people 18 to 29, you see sort of overwhelming support for Sanders. What do I think that means, given my sort of more general claims about the pro-government American? I don't think, and I don't think there's survey evidence to support the idea that young people are actually more committed to socialism than older people, though they are less frightened of the term. And that, I think, is the point. For younger people, and in fact, I'm, by the way, 34, so I'm just over the border of millennial. I'm almost someone who people are interested in hearing from, but I'm not. I was born in October of 1981, so I missed the cutoff by 2 months. But for people younger than me, I think, even for me, the tax revolt is not a salient political memory for me. Reagan is not a salient political memory for me. So people in my age or younger grew up in a time when you could vote for tax increases, when that's something that happened, right? They grew up in a time where you saw the struggle it was to pass legislation, like, for instance, Obamacare, which is a massively redistributional policy, the struggle that you faced, even if you're trying to do very moderate policy, right? So I think that for young people, it may be the case that the things Sanders is talking about don't seem as politically impossible because the salient political memories of the sort of Reagan era are not salient to them. And so I think that for many older Democrats, they think that Sanders' plans are good. They're just pie in the sky. I think younger people, that's not how they're seeing those policies. Now I want to talk about overlapping inequalities, right? And I think this has been a really major part of the Democratic campaign. I almost can't overstate how important this is for the Democratic Party right now. You may remember these. This is a rally that Bernie Sanders was doing in Seattle on the question of Social Security. It got interrupted by Black Lives Matter protesters. This is Hillary Clinton. This is a small, large donor event that Black Lives Matter or a Black Lives Matter supporter managed to get into and held up this sign. I don't know if you can read it. It says, "We have to bring them to heel," which is a quote from Hillary Clinton during the sort of crime bill super predator era. I think the most important thing to recognize about what Black Lives Matter has done in targeting Democrats is that they've succeeded overwhelmingly at changing the rhetoric in this country. Now, it's a political campaign, so all we're talking about is rhetoric, right? This is not policy change at a national level, and there are many reasons to think that policy change at a national level is really hard. But in a political campaign, changing the dialogue is success, by really any standard, and Black Lives Matter changed the debate. And I think they don't get nearly enough credit for doing so. So this is Bernie Sanders' racial justice plan, which talks about five central types of violence waged against blacks, including physical, political, legal, economic, and environmental violence. I think this is a remarkable change of language for Bernie Sanders. And this is a screenshot of a speech that Hillary Clinton gave where she sort of famously referred to what had happened in Flint as being intersectional, right? Which is, again, really different language for that generation of Democrats. So I think that, and this is actually part of a larger trend that I think is worth thinking about, the Tea Party targeted their friends too, right? The Tea Party went to the mat to take down moderate Republicans, right? And they won, right? And I think you see the same thing in the LGBT community. They targeted Barack Obama really strongly when he was not evolving fast enough on marriage equality, and they won too. So I think there's a, it's not to say that you always win if you do this, but I think that you get a lot of backlash right at the time when you decide as a sort of grassroots campaign to go against people who are seen as your allies, but I think that there's pretty strong evidence that at least sometimes it works. Now, the reason this is so important, not only because I think it's fundamentally changed what Democrats are talking about, it's important because the question of overlapping inequalities, right, racial inequality and economic inequality in this country, the question of racial, like, inequality has a fundamental role in changing the likelihood of being able to develop the kind of programs Bernie Sanders talks about, right? So this is a chart that shows the relationship between social spending and racial fractionalization. Racial fractionalization is basically a measure of diversity from zero, where everyone in your country is the same racially, to, you know, 0.7, which is countries that are far, far more diverse, like Ecuador. And you can see the United States is right there with Brazil. We're a very diverse country. And then social spending measured as a percent of GDP. It's a rough measure, but basically, you know, the size of your welfare state is the y-axis, right? So in the top corner, well, actually, let's look at Denmark, because Bernie Sanders talks a fair amount about Denmark. This is the country he turns to as an example of what a country that the United States should be more like, right? Denmark spends a lot more in social spending than the United States. Denmark is also not a very diverse country, right? And you see the countries up there, the Sweden, Netherlands, they're not very diverse countries that manage to spend a lot on social safety net programs, right? So this question is not just a question for the Democrats, right? Can you overcome, can you resolve racial inequalities in a way that allows working class people to unite behind stronger welfare spending, right? This is a worldwide problem. It's a worldwide challenge for the left. And so I think that to the extent that we're seeing right now a renewed interest in addressing racial disparities in this country on the left, I think it's a powerfully optimistic moment if what you're interested in doing is moving the United States up, up the chart, right? I mean, it would make us an exceptional country to be able to be both diverse and have a safety net that actually catches people. All right. So that, I think, is one of the fundamental things we're seeing right now. The last thing I want to talk about very, very briefly is movement consolidation. So what I put a few buttons here you may recognize. Howard Dean for America became Democracy for America. This is Organizing for America, which is Barack Obama's organization after his election as president. And so the question is, will Bernie Sanders, with his very large crowds, manage to turn that into an institutional powerhouse? Or not, right? I think everyone, so I think that right now you can't say, right? Because I think anyone who was going to be guessing the answer to that when they saw Obama for America might have guessed wrong, right? Obama for America looked like a very well-established organization, very well-run, very locally run, and then it didn't, I think, pan out the way that some people who've been quite optimistic about it, you know, had hoped. So I want to talk just briefly about what movement consolidation might mean. I don't think I can answer the Sanders, institutional question right now. But if we're going to see movement consolidation, I would point to the state legislatures as a place that those interested in institutionalizing the kind of momentum we've seen with Sanders, I would point them to the state level. This is a chart that just shows the partisan breakdown of state legislatures over time from 78 or to 2015. And as you can see, the red bars are Republican control, the blue bars are Democratic control, the gray bars are between the two. And as you can see, there's, you know, it's up and down, but Republicans, I think there's a general trend towards more Republican control of state legislatures, and certainly we're seeing very strong Republican control in recent years. And so if you want to talk about, you know, a political revolution, or if you're Hillary Clinton and don't want to talk about a political revolution but would like to get things done, I think that if you look at the experience of Obamacare, you cannot ignore what happens in the state legislatures, right? National policy does not just get decided at the national level, even if you control both houses of Congress, all right? All right, so that's what I want to say about the left. So these are the things I said, right? I talked to you about grassroots conservatives and their beliefs. I talked about the rise of the right-wing media and its control. I talked about how there are various competing political entrepreneurs. We see the Koch brothers, we see Donald Trump. I tried to suggest to you that maybe Americans are not as anti-government as they have often been said to be. I talked about the challenge of economic and racial inequalities and how those overlap in this country. And then I talked a little bit about what are the possibilities or potential of movement consolidation. So instead of talking about Sanders and Trump, I think I have sort of two takeaways. On the left, I would say that there is a potential, at least, if you look at public opinion, for a return to sort of traditional democratic economic policies of the Great Society, of the New Deal. But there's a long space between opinion and policy. And so that potential, I think, is challenged, continues to be challenged by overlapping inequalities and the structure of U.S. governmental institutions, right? The sort of role, the many veto points at the federal level plus all of the states. Finally, I want to talk about processes on the right. The ongoing appeal of racial and ethnic nationalism in the conservative base has not, interestingly, to me anyway, been converted into ideological free marketism. That their ideas overlap in many ways with not wanting a large social safety net, for instance, but it also fails in some ways when you try and cut Social Security or support free trade. And then finally, I'll say that the decay of Republican institutions, I talked about the media, I talked about the sort of the RNC and the Republican Party institutionally, the decay of Republican institutions is really striking, but it may not mean the failure of conservative priorities, because to the extent that you can achieve your goals via gridlock, you don't actually need to be able to make a national majority coalition. All right, that's it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very, very much.
You're listening to a program by Global Voices for Justice, a nonprofit media organization. You can visit our website at globalvoicesforjustice.org or reach us at 310-283-0885. This is a panel discussion on the 2016 presidential election. Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment, which was held at UCLA on April 11, 2016. We just heard from author Vanessa Williamson. Up next, Professor Cedric Johnson, who teaches African American Studies and Political Science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His teaching and research interests include African American political thought, neoliberal politics, and class analysis and race. Cedric Johnson is the author of Revolutionaries to Race Leaders, Black Power and the Making of African American Politics, and editor of The Neoliberal Deluge, Hurricane Katrina, Late Capitalism, and the Remaking of New Orleans.
All right, good afternoon. I also want to do something which might be a little bit unorthodox, and that's to dedicate my comments today to Savannah Carroll, who was a young black political scientist who died last Thursday morning after a year-long bout with cancer. She had just graduated with her PhD from University of Massachusetts and was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. And was just a great, great person who I got to know when she was a graduate student, and really handled this battle that she had with just a considerable amount of grace. And so I just wanted to acknowledge her briefly. The first thing I'll say is that this has to be the most exciting election cycle that I've experienced, certainly as an adult, right? I can remember the Jesse Jackson campaigns in part, but I think this is really different in so many ways. I want to start by saying that this is not strictly about Sanders, the excitement that I have and the excitement that other people have, that there's the importance of this political figure who's helped to catalyze or crystallize certain tensions or contradictions in society, but at the same time, I think Sanders is the result of a number of dramatic changes and developments over the past decade or two, right? And I'm thinking about the anti-globalization struggles of the late 1990s, the anti-war campaigns of the Bush years, Occupy demonstrations, responses to Hurricane Katrina, anti-eviction organizing, the Fight for 15, revitalization of unions in different parts of the country, in particular in the realm of education. So I think what we're looking at is something which is more than just an election campaign or an important or distinctive candidate, but really the cresting of various social movements and tendencies within society around this particular campaign. Part of what I'm going to say is going to seem fairly straightforward, and it may even seem for some people to be overly simplistic, but I think it's worth saying, and maybe we can have some discussion about it, about the problems, if there are any. But in terms of framing both the Sanders phenomenon and the Trump phenomenon, part of what I want to focus on are two things. One is the crisis of neoliberalism as a dominant ideology, which has been a consistent thread starting with the Reagan years all the way up through the Obama presidency. Certainly it varies from one presidential candidate, different congresses to the next, but for the most part, both the establishment Republican Party and the new Democrats have cohered around a support for neoliberalization, the hollowing out of the old New Deal social democracy, and the advancement of a really strong pro-market set of solutions to various problems that exist throughout the society. So on the one hand, I want to think about the crisis of neoliberalism as an ideology, and also the conditions of the working class. And I want to use that word, and I think Sanders, this moment, allows us to use it in ways that we haven't used it for decades. So I want to use that and foreground this notion of the working class. And I think when we talk about those two things, the crisis of neoliberalism and the conditions of the working class in the U.S. at this particular moment, it really throws into sharp relief why Trump has had some traction in this campaign. It also shows why Clinton seems to be losing ground over the last six or seven contests, and why Sanders, despite everything he's doing, which in the past decade or even 20 years or so would have totally made him a non-starter as a candidate. I mean, this guy's hunching over the podium. He's rolling his eyes during debates. He's kind of like the typical sort of curmudgeonly guy who nobody sees as presidential, but yet he's gaining ground, he's gaining support. And so why is that the case? And I think, again, when we think about this crisis of neoliberalism as a dominant ideology and, the conditions of the working class, it makes sense, right? We get a sense of why he's doing what he's doing and why he's doing so well. Now, in terms of class, even though I will refer to the typical metrics in a few moments, I was really excited when I saw Vanessa's graph, which showed this change from the subjective identification with the middle class, which really dominated the Cold War years, where that was the desirable category for people to associate with, to now this convergence where we tend to see people referring to themselves and candidates referring to people as workers and working class, again, in a way which is unapologetic and untainted by the red baiting of earlier periods. So I'm excited about that, and I think that one of the things I want to foreground, again, is this notion of not thinking of class in terms of education or consumer capacity, but to get back to the older notion of the social relations of production, and in particular, not just thinking about it in terms of wage labor, right? I mean, this is an important dimension of it that a lot of people have been writing about recently, right? So there's a tendency to think of the proletariat, right, the old notion strictly in terms of wage labor, when in fact, I don't think that's how Marx and Engels wrote about it, right? They actually wrote about it in some more complicated ways. And instead of thinking of the working class or the proletariat as a synonym for wage labor, I agree with Michael Denning's view that we should think about it in terms of dispossession, expropriation, and radical dependence on the market, which is something which is shared widely and in different ways by people across the society. Once we start doing that, I think we come up with some different solutions to the problems that we face. So discussions of class and capitalism have emerged in this election in ways that they haven't in previous moments, but not without problems. And I want to try to tackle some of the popular myths that have circulated widely over the past few months. In particular, I want to attack this notion of the white poor, the white worker that's been kicked around in so many circles. It seems like every time I give a talk, this becomes a main bone of contention in the audience, right? At the same time, I want to take up this notion of the black vote, which has been equally sloppy and unhelpful in the way that most folks talk about it. So I want to sketch out how these different campaigns reflect these deeper contradictions within capitalist society and the various challenges and battle lines, as well as potential for working class-led popular democratic left politics suited to our times. So why Trump? I'm probably going to overlap a little bit with Vanessa here, but You know, Trump is not an exception to the default mode of operating that we've seen from the Republican Party for decades now, right? I mean, if anything, and I can't remember who exactly said this first, so this is not completely original, he's just a Frankenstein version of every ugly, mean, antisocial position or campaign strategy they've used, all thrown together, stitched together, and shot through with not electricity, but, you know, popular discontent, right? So that's what we're looking at. And just like the Frankenstein monster, he's out of control, right? I mean, that's been the main problem for the establishment, that they can't necessarily control him. I think Charlie Post pointed out recently in a piece that he also doesn't really represent a particular block of capital, right? He's not connected in the same ways to standing organizations which might demand more in the way of accountability. To understand the Trump phenomenon, I want to return to a terrible book. Don't read it. This is not an endorsement of it. But there's a shard of truth in it that I want to return to, right? It's a book by Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam, two Republican Party insiders who wrote a book after the 2006 midterm elections, right? And the book was called The Grand New Party. Totally not an endorsement, right? So don't run out and buy it. But basically what they said was that the Republican Party needed to secure a working class base, that it needed to go from not the party of Wall Street, it needed to become the party of Walmart, was their argument. There are a lot of nifty little things that they say here and there. But their solution for it is lame, right? Their solution was basically that the party should rely on various ways of incentivizing the, you know, patriarchal, heteronormative nuclear family, right? You know, incentivize marriage. A lot of the things we've heard before, but they had like this entire agenda built around that as a way of addressing the hardships that people are facing. And so that's the what they're saying in a nutshell. But the part of the argument that I find intriguing is where they talk about the unfinished realignment. And maybe this goes back to this question of the disintegration or, you know, disarray of the Republican Party. They argue that over the past few decades, neither party has been able to consolidate a popular base beyond one or two presidential elections. And, you know, what you see essentially is working class voters migrating back and forth between the two parties, right? Reagan Democrats, you know, those who crossed the aisle to support Obama, I guess. So what they basically argue in the midst of those 2006 midterm defeats is that the Republican Party is fighting a losing battle demographically, culturally, and even in terms of national contests. They don't really see them as having much success going forward, right? That they'll have much more difficult time as the nation becomes more diverse, as it begins to look more like Los Angeles and Chicago and New York City. They will not be able to win national contests because, you know, not just generationally, but culturally, right? We're veering towards a society where people are much more tolerant, much more accepting, particularly within the metropolitan centers, with some exceptions. So part of what they're fearful of, and I think this is the jumping off point and where we can connect it back to Trump, they're fearful that, you know, unless the party does that, it responds to people's real needs, responds to their actual material hardships, that it will become a party of extinction, right? It won't last. And it's that seems to be the case in some point, which might not be a bad thing. But when we think about Trump, one way to think about him, I know I've given the Frankenstein notion as a way of thinking about him, but I also think that he's really just Pat Buchanan all over again, except with money and with a brand name, right? The things that Pat didn't have, luckily. But I think, part of what he's speaking to and why people are attracted to him is that he's providing them with a set of solutions, you know, building walls, excluding immigrants, engaging in some sort of protectionist policies, which are all wrong-headed. But they seem to be solutions which stand outside of either the establishment of the Republican Party or the Democratic Leadership Council, right? That if anything, many of the people who are flocking towards Trump see those entities as responsible for a lot of the problems that they're facing, the jobless recovery that exists in so many places, as well as the violence of globalization, right, that people are feeling throughout the Rust Belt. Now, in all of this, I think that the Sanders strategy, right, of organizing around a progressive set of policies to address people's, you know, felt needs is the way to go. And I'll just be clear about that. And I think it's necessary if we're going to kill this Archie Bunker notion of the white working class, which still circulates, unfortunately, in society. So I've heard this repeated ad nauseum on social media, in dinner party conversations all over the place, which is that why is it these dumb white workers continue to support people like Trump? Why do they vote against their own interests, right? You hear this stuff. I'm sure you all have heard it, right? You're all looking at me like you've heard it, right? I was at a conference a few weeks ago at the University of Wisconsin-Madison on race, property, and debt. And this came up in a clear form. People repeated it, right? The people who are voting for Trump are just white workers. They're uneducated. They're dumb. They're voting against their interests, so forth. And what dawned on me is that this always comes up. It's always voiced as a third-person narrative. It's never offered up when there's actual white working-class people in the room, right? And usually it happens in a room like this, where there's air conditioning and electricity and people are, you know, fairly comfortable. And so that bothered me. But I think it's necessary to take it on, right? I was in...
This was the first part of a two-part program by Global Voices for Justice on the 2016 presidential election. Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment, which was held at UCLA on April 11, 2016. We heard from author Vanessa Williamson and Professor Cedric Johnson. Special thanks to Mansur Saba, Brian Lindquist, the Center for Social Theory and Comparative History at UCLA, Professor Robert Brenner, and Aaron Beninov. This is Jeannie Kyle. Global Voices for Justice is a nonprofit media organization in Los Angeles, California. To contact us or obtain copies of this or other programs, please visit our website at globalvoicesforjustice.org or call us at 310-283-0885. That's 310-283-0885. Thanks for listening.
And that was Voices for Global Justice on KBOO Portland, sharing with us their production of a panel discussion on the 2016 presidential election, Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment.